Holwyn scripts for a hefty surcharge. In the onion light through paper shades, in the furnished rooms of strung-out nurses who financed their own cages' maintenance with stolen pharmaceutical samples. In the isopropyl reek of the storefront offices of stooped old chain-smoking MDs whose script pads were always out and who needed only to hear pain and see cash. In the home of a snot-strangled Canadian VIP and the office of an implacable Revere ADA whose wife has opted for dentures at 35. AA's disciplinarian looked damn good and smelled even better and dressed to impress, and his blank, black-on-yellow smile never faltered as he sincerely urged you to have a nice day. Just one. And that was the first night that cynical Gately willingly took the basic suggestion to get down on his big knees by his undersized, spring-shot, Ennett House bunk and ask for help from something he still didn't believe in. Ask for his own sick spider-bit will to be taken from him and fumigated and squished. But, and plus, in Boston AA there is unfortunately dogma, too, it turns out. And some of it is both dated and smug. And there's an off-putting jargon in the fellowship, a psycho-babbly dialect that's damn near impossible to follow at first, says Ken Erdetti, the college boy ad exec, semi-new at Ennett House, complaining to Gately at the white flag meetings raffle break. Boston AA meetings are unusually long, an hour and a half instead of the national hour, but here they also have this formal break at about 45 minutes where everybody can grab a sandwich, or Oreo, and a sixth cup of coffee and stand around and chat and bond, where people can pull their sponsors aside and can find some trite insight or emotional snafu that the sponsor can swiftly, privately validate, but also place in the larger imperative context of the primary need not to absorb a substance today, just today, no matter what happens. While everybody's bonding and interfacing in a bizarre system of catchphrases, there's also the raffle, another Boston idiosyncrasy. The newest of the white flag newcomers, trying to get active in group service, wobble around with rattan baskets and packs of tickets. One for a buck and three for a fin, and the winner eventually gets announced from the podium, and everyone hisses and shouts, "Fix!" and laughs. And the winner wins a big book, or an As Bill Sees It, or a Came to Believe. Which, if he's got some sober time in, and already owns all the AA literature from winning previous raffles, he'll stand up and publicly offer it to any newcomer who wants it, which means any newcomer with enough humble desperation to come up to him and ask for it, and risk being given a phone number to carry around in his wallet. At the white flag raffle break, Gately usually stands around chain-smoking with the Ennett House residents, so that he's casually available to answer questions and empathize with complaints. He usually waits till after the meeting to do his own complaining to ferocious Francis, with whom Gately now shares the important duty of breaking down the hall, sweeping floors and emptying ashtrays and wiping down the long cafeteria tables, which ferocious Francis G's function is limited because he's on oxygen, and his function consists mostly of standing there sucking oxygen and holding an unlit cigar, while Gately breaks down the hall. Gately rather likes Ken Erdetti, who came into the house about a month ago from some cushy Belmont rehab. Erdetti's an upscale guy, what Gately's mother would have called a yuppie, an account executive at Vinnie and Veal's Advertising downtown, his intake form said. And though he's about Gately's age, he's so softly good-looking, in that soft, mannequinish way Harvard and Tufts schoolboys have, and look so smooth and groomed all the time, even in jeans and a plain cotton sweater, that Gately thinks of him as much younger, totally ungrizzled, and refers to him mentally as kid. Erdetti's in the house mainly for marijuana addiction, which Gately has a hard time identifying with anybody getting in enough trouble with weed to leave his job and condo to bunk in a room full of tattooed guys who smoke in their sleep, and to work like pumping gas, Erdetti just started his 9-month humility job at the Merit Station down by North Harvard Street in Alston for 32 minimum wage hours a week. Or to have his leg be joggling like that all the time from tensions of withdrawal. From fucking grass? But it's not Gately's place to say what's bad enough to make somebody come in and what isn't. Not for anybody else but himself. And the shapely but big-time troubled new girl, Kate Gompert, who mostly just stays in her bed in the new women's 5-woman room when she isn't at meetings and is on a suicidality contract with Pat and isn't getting the usual pressure to get a humility job and gets to get some sort of script meds out of the men's locker every morning. Kate Gompert's counselor, Danielle S., reported at the last staff meeting that Kate had finally opened up and told her she'd mostly come in for weed, too. And not the lightweight prescription tranks she'd listed on her intake form. Gately used to treat weed like tobacco. He wasn't like some other narcotics addicts who smoked weed when they couldn't get anything else. He always smoked weed and could always get something else and simply smoked weed while he did whatever else he could get. Gately doesn't miss weed much. The shocker type AA miracle is he doesn't much miss the Demerol either today. A hard November wind is spattering goopy sleet against the broad windows all around the hall. The Provident Nursing Home cafeteria is lit by a checkerboard array of oversized institutional bulbs overhead, a few of which are always low and give off fluttery strobes. The fluttering bulbs are why Pat Montesian and all the other photic seizure-prone area AAs never go to White Flag, opting for the freeway group over in Brookline. Or the candy-ass Lake Street meeting up in West Newton on Sunday nights, which Pat M. bizarrely drives all the way up from her home down on the South Shore in Milton to get to hear people talk about their analysts and sobs. There is no way to account for people's taste in AA. The White Flag Hall is so brightly lit up, all Gately can see out any of the windows is a kind of shiny, drooling black against everybody's pale reflection. Miracles, one of the Boston AA terms Erdetti and the brand new and very shaky, veiled girl resident standing over him complain they find hard to stomach. As in, we're all miracles here, and don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle happens, and to stay sober for 24 hours is a miracle. Except the brand new girl, either Joelle V or Joelle D, who said, she'd hit the occasional meeting in the past before her bottom and had been roundly repelled and is still pretty much cynical and repelled. She said on the way down to Provident under Gately's direct new resident supervision, says she finds even the word miracle preferable to the constant talk about the grace of God, which reminds her of wherever she grew up, where she's indicated places of worship were often aluminum trailers or fiberboard shacks, and churchgoers played with copperheads in the services to honor something about serpents and tongues. Gately's also observed how Erdetti's also got that Tufts, Harvard way of speaking without seeming to move his lower jaw.
It's as if it's its own country or something, Erdetti complains, legs crossed in maybe a bit of a faggy schoolboy way, looking around at the raffle break, sitting in Gately's generous shadow.
The first time I ever talked, over at the St. E's meeting on Wednesday, somebody comes up after the Lord's Prayer and says, good to hear you, I could really ID with that bottom you were sharing about and isolating. The can't and can't, it's the greenest I've felt in months hearing you. And then gives me this raffle ticket with his phone number that I didn't ask for and says, I'm right where I'm supposed to be, which I have to say I found a bit patronizing.
The best noise Gately produces is his laugh, which booms and reassures, and a certain haunted hardness goes out of his face when he laughs. Like most huge men, Gately has kind of a high, hoarse speaking voice. His larynx sounds compressed.
I still hate the right way you're supposed to be thing,
he says, laughing. He likes that Erdetti, sitting, looks right up at him and cocks his head slightly to let Gately know he's got his full attention. Gately doesn't know that this is a requisite for a white-collar job, where you have to show you're attending fully to clients who are paying major sums, and get to expect an overt display of full attention. Gately is still not yet a good judge of anything about upscale people except where they tend to hide their valuables. Boston AA, with its emphasis on the group, is intensely social. The raffle break goes on and on. An intoxicated street guy with a venulated nose and missing incisors and electrician's tape wrapped around his shoes is trying to sing Volare up at the empty podium microphone. He is gently, cheerfully induced offstage by a crocodile with a sandwich and an arm around the shoulders. There's a certain pathos to the crocodile's kindness. His clean flannel arm around the weather-stained shoulders, which pathos Gately feels and likes being able to feel it, while he says, "But at least the good to hear you, I quit minding. It's just what they say when somebody's got done speaking. They can't say, like, good job or you spoke well, because it can't be anybody's place here to judge if anybody else did good or bad or whatnot. You know what I'm saying, Tiny Dan?" Tiny Yule, in a blue suit and laser chronometer and tiny shoes, whose shine you could read by, is sharing a dirty aluminum ashtray with Nell Gunther, who has a glass eye, which she amuses herself by usually wearing so the pupil and iris face in, and the dead white and tiny manufacturer specifications on the back of the eye face out. Both of them are pretending to study the blonde false wood of the tabletop, and Ewell makes a bit of a hostile show of not looking up or responding to Gately or entering into the conversation in any way, which is his choice and on him alone, so Gately lets it go. Wade McDade has a Walkman going, which is technically okay at the raffle break, although it's not a real good idea. Chandler Foss is flossing his teeth and pretending to throw the used floss at Jennifer Belbin. Most of the Ennett House residents are mingling satisfactorily. The couple of residents that are black are mingling with other blacks.
141.
The Deal Kid and Dooney Glynn are amusing themselves, telling homosexuality jokes to Morris Hanley, who sits smoothing his hair with his fingertips, pretending to not even acknowledge, his left hand still bandaged. Alfonso Parias Carbo is standing with three Alston group guys, smiling broadly and nodding, not understanding a word anybody says. Bruce Green has gone downstairs to the men's head and amused Gately by asking his permission first. Gately told him to go knock himself out. Green has good big arms and no gut, even after all the substances, and Gately suspects he might have played some ball at some point. Kate Gompert is totally by herself at a non-smoking table over by a window, ignoring her pale reflection and making little cardboard tents out of her raffle tickets and moving them around. Glenette Henderson clutches another black girl and laughs and says, "Girl!" several times. Emil Minty is clutching his head. Jeff Day, in his black turtleneck and blazer, keeps lurking on the fringes of various groups of people, pretending he's part of the conversations. No immediate sign of Bert F. Smith or Charlotte Treat. Randy Lentz, in his cognito white mustache and sideburns, is doubtless at the payphone in the northeast corner of the Provident lobby downstairs. Lentz spends nearly unacceptable amounts of time either on a phone or trying to get in position to use a phone. "'Cause what I like," Gately says to Erdetti. Erdetti really is listening, even though there's a compellingly cheap young woman in a brief white skirt and absurd black mesh stockings sitting with her legs nicely crossed. One strap low-spike black Ferragamos, too. At the periphery of his vision, and the woman is with a large man, which makes her even more compelling. And also the veiled new girl's breasts and her hips, clefts, are compelling and distracting next to him, even in a long, baggy, loose blue sweater that matches the embroidered selvage around her veil.
"What I think I like is how 'it was good to hear you' ends up like saying two separate things together."
Gately's also saying this to Joelle, who, it's weird, but you can tell she's looking at you, even through the linen veil. There's maybe half a dozen or so other veiled people in the White Flag Hall tonight. A decent percentage of people in the 11-step union of the hideously and improbably deformed, are also in 12-step fellowships for other issues besides hideous deformity. Most of the room's veiled AAs are women, though there is this one male, veiled, UHID guy that's an active white flagger, Tommy S. or F., who years ago nodded out on a stuffed acrylic couch with a bottle of Ramy and a lit Tipperillo. The guy now wears UHID veils and a whole spectrum of silk turtlenecks and assorted hats and classy lambskin driving gloves. Gately's had the UHID and veil philosophy explained to him in passing a couple times, but still doesn't much get it. It seems like a gesture of shame and concealment still to him, the veil. Pat Montesian had said there's been a few other UHIDs who'd gone through Ennett House prior to the year of dairy products from the American heartland, which is when new resident Gately came wobbling in. But this Joelle Van Dyne, who Gately feels he has zero handle on yet as a person, or how serious she is about putting down substances and coming in to really get straight, this Joelle is the first veiled resident Gately's had under him as a staffer. This Joelle girl, that wasn't even on the 2-month waiting list for intake, got in overnight under some private arrangement with somebody on the house's board of directors, upscale Enfield guys into charity and directing. There'd been no intake interview with Pat at the house. The girl just showed up 2 days ago, right after supper. She'd been up at Brigham and Women's for 5 days after some sort of horrific OD-type situation, said to have included both defib paddles and priests. She'd had real luggage and this, like, Chinese portable dressing screen thing with clouds and Popeye dragons that even folded lengthwise. Took both Green and Parias Carbo to lug upstairs. There's been no talk of a humility job for her, and Pat's counseling the girl personally. Pat's got some sort of privately directed arrangement with the girl. Gately's already seen enough private-type arrangements between certain staffers and residents to feel like it's maybe kind of a character defect of Ennett House. A girl from the Brookline Young People's Group over in a cheerleader skirt and slut stockings is ignoring all the ashtrays and putting her extra-long gasper out on the bare tabletop 2 rows over as she laughs like a seal at something an acneed guy in a long camel hair coat he hasn't taken off and sockless leather dance shoes Gately's never seen at a meeting before, says. And he's got his hand on hers as she grinds the gasper out, something like putting a cigarette out against the wood-grain plastic table, which Gately can already see the ragged black burned divot that's formed. It's something the rankness of which would never have struck him one way or the other before, until Gately took on half the break down the hall and wipe down the tables job at ferocious Francis G.'s suggestion, and now he feels sort of propriety about the Providence tabletops. But it's not like he can go over and take anybody else's inventory and tell them how to behave. He settles for imagining the girl pinwheeling through the air toward a glass wall.
When they say it, it sort of means like what you said was good for them. It helped them out somehow, he says. But plus now, also, I like saying it myself because if you think about it, it also means it was good to be able to hear you, to really hear.
He's trying subtly to alternate and look at Erdetti and Joelle both, like he's addressing them both. It's not something he's good at. His head's too big to be subtle with.
Because I remember for like the first 60 days or so, I couldn't hear shit. I didn't hear nothing. I'd just sit there and compare. I'd go to myself like, I never rolled a car. I never lost a wife. I never bled from the rectum. Jean would tell me to just keep coming for a while, and sooner or later I'd be able to both listen and hear. He said it's hard to really hear. But he wouldn't say what was the difference between hearing and listening, which pissed me off. But after a while, I started to really hear. It turns out, and this is just for me maybe, but it turned out hearing the speaker means like all of a sudden hearing how fucking similar the way he felt and the way I felt were, out there, at the bottom, before we each came in. Instead of just sitting here, resenting being here, and thinking how he bled from the ass and I didn't, and how that means I'm not as bad as him yet, and I can still be out there.
One of the tricks of being a real service to newcomers is not to lecture or give advice, but only talk about your own personal experience and what you were told, and what you found out personally, and to do it in a casual but positive and encouraging way. Plus, you're supposed to try and identify with the newcomer's feelings as much as possible. Ferocious Francis G. says this is one of the ways guys with just a year or two sober can be most helpful, being able to sincerely ID with the newly sick and suffering. Ferocious Francis told Gately as they were wiping down tables that if a crocodile with decades of sober AA time can still sincerely empathize and identify with a whacked-out, bug-eyed, disease-ridden newcomer, then there's something deeply fucked up about that crocodile's recovery. The crocodiles, decades sober, live in a totally different spiritual galaxy inside. One long-timer describes it as, he has a whole new, unique, interior, spiritual castle now to live in. Part of this new Joelle girl's pull for Ken Urdetti isn't just the sexual thing of her body, which he finds made way sexier, by the way, the overlarge blue coffee-stained sweater tries to downplay the body thing without being so hubristic as to try to hide it. Sloppy sexiness pulls Urdetti in, like a well-groomed moth, to a lit window. But it's also the veil, wondering what horrific contrast to the body's allure lies, swollen or askew under that veil. It gives the pull a perverse sideways slant that makes it even more distracting. And so, Urdetti cocks his head a little more up at Gately and narrows his eyes to make his listening look terribly intense. He doesn't know that there's an abstract distance in the look that makes it seem like he's studying a real bitch of a 7-iron on the 10th rough or something. The look doesn't communicate what he thinks his audience wants it to. The raffle break is winding down as everybody starts to want their own ashtray. Two more big urns of coffee emerge from the kitchen door over by the literature table. Urdetti is probably the second biggest leg and foot joggler in present residence after Jeffrey D. Joelle Van Dyne now says something very strange. It's a very strange little moment, right at the end of the raffle break, and Gately later finds it impossible to describe it in his log entry for the PM shift. It's the first time he realizes that Joelle's voice, crisp and rich and oddly empty, her accent just barely Southern, and with a strange, and it turns out Kentuckian lapse in the pronunciation of all apicals except S, is familiar in a faraway way that both makes it familiar and yet lets Gately be sure he's never once met her before, out there. She inclines the plane of her blue-bordered veil briefly toward the floor's tile. Very bad tile. Scab, colored, nauseous, worst thing about the big room by far. Brings it back up level. Unlike Urdetti, she's standing, and in flats is nearly Gately's height, and says that she's finding it especially hard to take when these earnest, ravaged folks at the lectern say they're here but for the grace of God. Except that's not the strange thing she says, because when Gately nods hard and starts to interject about it was the same for, and wants to launch into a fairly standard Boston AA agnostic soothing riff about the God in the slogan being just shorthand for a totally subjective and up-to-you higher power, and AA being merely spiritual instead of dogmatically religious, a sort of benign anarchy of subjective spirit, Joelle cuts off his interjection and says that but that her trouble with it is that but for the grace of God is a subjunctive, a counterfactual, she says, and can make sense only when introducing a conditional clause, like, for example, but for the grace of God, I would have died on Molly Notkin's bathroom floor. So that an indicative transposition like, I'm here but for the grace of God, is, she says, literally senseless. And regardless of whether she hears it or not, it's meaningless. And that the foamy enthusiasm with which these folks can say what in fact means nothing at all makes her want to put her head in a radar range at the thought that substances have brought her to the sort of pass where this is the sort of language she has to have blind faith in. Gately looks at a rectangular blue, selvaged expanse of clean linen, whose gentle rises barely allude to any features below. He looks at her and has no idea whether she's serious or not, or whacked, or trying like Dr. Jeff Day to erect denial-type fortifications with some kind of intellectualish showing off. And he doesn't know what to say in reply. He has absolutely nothing in his huge, square head to identify with her with, or latch onto, or say in encouraging reply. And for an instant, the Provident cafeteria seems pin-drop silent, and his own heart grips him like an infant rattling the bars of its playpen, and he feels a greasy wave of an old, an almost unfamiliar panic. And for a second, it seems inevitable that at some point in his life, he's going to get high again and be back in the cage all over again. Because for a second, the blank white veil leveled at him seems a screen on which might well be projected a casual and impressive black and yellow smiley face, grinning. And he feels all the muscles in his own face loosen and descend kneeward. And the moment hangs there, distended, until the White Flag Raffle coordinator for November, Glenn Kay, glides up to the podium mic in his scarlet velour caparison and makeup and candelabrum with candles the same color as the floor tile, and uses the plastic gavel to formally end the break and bring things back to whatever passes here for order for the raffle drawing. The Watertown guy with mid-level sober time, who wins the big book, publicly offers it to any newcomer who wants it. And Gately is pleased to see Bruce Green raise a big hand, and decides he'll just turn it over and ask ferocious Francis G. for feedback on subjunctives and countersexuals. And the infant leaves its playpen alone inside him. And the rivets of the long table his seat's attached to make a brief distressed noise as he sits and settles in for the second half of the meeting, asking silently for help to be determined, to try to really hear, or die trying. New York City's harbors Liberty Island's gigantic lady has the sun for a crown and holds what looks like a huge photo album under one iron arm, and the other arm holds aloft a product. The product is changed each 1st of January by brave men with pitons and cranes. But it's funny what they'll find funny, AAs at Boston meetings, listening. The next advanced basics guy summoned by their gleaming bald Western wear chairman to speak is dreadfully, transparently unfunny, painfully new but pretending to be at ease, to be an old hand, desperate to amuse and impress them. The guy's got the sort of professional background where he's used to trying to impress gatherings of persons. He's dying to be liked up there. He's performing. The White Flag crowd can see all this. Even the true morons among them see right through the guy. This is not a regular audience. A Boston AA is very sensitive to the presence of ego. When the new guy introduces himself and makes an ironic gesture and says, "I'm told I've been given the gift of desperation. I'm looking for the exchange window." It's so clearly unspontaneous, rehearsed, plus commits the subtle but cardinal message offense of appearing to deprecate the program rather than the self, that just a few polite titters resound, and people shift in their seats with a slight but signal discomfort. The worst punishment Gately's seen inflicted on a commitment speaker is when the host crowd gets embarrassed for him. Speakers who are accustomed to figuring out what an audience wants to hear and then supplying it find out quickly that this particular audience does not want to be supplied with what someone else thinks it wants. It's another conundrum Gately finally ran out of cerebral steam on. Part of finally getting comfortable in Boston AA is just finally running out of steam in terms of trying to figure stuff like this out. Because it literally makes no sense. Close to 200 people all punishing somebody by getting embarrassed for him, killing him, by empathetically dying right there with him, for him, up there at the podium. The applause when this guy's done has the relieved feel of a fist unclenching, and their cries of, "Keep coming!" are so sincere, it's almost painful. But then, in equally paradoxical contrast, have a look at the next advanced basic speaker. This tall, baggy sack of a man, also painfully new, but this poor bastard here completely and openly nerve-wracked, wobbling his way up to the front, his face shiny with sweat and his talk full of blank cunctations and disassociated leaps.
As the guy speaks with terrible, abashed chagrin about trying to hang on to his job out there, as his AM hangovers became more and more debilitating, until he finally got so shaky and aphasic, he just couldn't bear to even face the customers who'd come knocking on his department's door. He was, from 0800 to 1600 hours, the complete department of Filene's department store.
What I did finally, Jesus, I don't know where I got such a stupid idea from. I brought this hammer in from home and brought it in and kept it right under my desk on the floor. And when somebody knocked at the door, I just sort of dive onto the floor and crawl under the desk and grab up the hammer. And I'd start into pounding on the leg of the desk real hard, like, you know, whack-a-da-whack-a-da, like I was fixing something down there. And if they opened the door finally and came in anyhow, or came in to bitch about me not opening the door, I'd just stay out of sight under there pounding away like hell, and I'd yell out I was going to be a moment, just a moment. Yeah. Emergency repairs. Be with them momentarily. I guess you can guess how all that pounding felt, you know, under there, with that big head I had every morning. I'd hide under there and pound with the hammer till they finally gave up and went away. I'd watch from under the desk and tell when they finally went away, from I could see their feet from under the desk. And about how the hiding under the desk and pounding thing worked, incredibly enough, for almost the whole last year of his drinking, which ended around this past Labor Day, when one vindictive complainant finally figured out where in Filene's to go to complain about the complaint department. The white flaggers all fell about. They were totally pleased and amused. The crocodiles removed their cigars and roared and wheezed and stomped both feet on the floor and showed scary teeth. Everyone roaring with identification and pleasure. Even this, though, as the speaker's confusion at their delight openly betrays, the story wasn't meant to be one bit funny. It was just the truth. Gately's found it's got to be the truth is the thing. He's trying hard to really hear the speakers. He stayed in the habit he'd developed as an Ennant resident of sitting right up there where he could see dentition and pores, with zero obstructions or heads between him and the podium. So the speaker fills his whole vision, which makes it easier to really hear, trying to concentrate on receiving the message instead of brooding on that odd old dark moment of aphasic terror with his veiled, like, pseudo-intellectual type girl, who was probably just in some sort of complex denial, or on whatever doubtlessly grim place he feels like he knows that smooth, echoless, slightly southern voice from. The thing is, it has to be the truth to really go over here. It can't be a calculated crowd pleaser, and it has to be the truth unslanted, unfortified, and maximally unironic. An ironist in a Boston AA meeting is a witch in church. Irony-free zone. Same with sly, disingenuous, manipulative pseudo-sincerity. Sincerity with an ulterior motive is something these tough, ravaged people know and fear. All of them trained to remember the coyly sincere, ironic, self-presenting fortifications they'd had to construct in order to carry on out there under the ceaseless neon bottle. This doesn't mean you can't pay empty or hypocritical lip service, however. Paradoxically enough, the desperate, newly sober white flaggers are always encouraged to invoke and pay empty lip service to slogans they don't yet understand or believe. For example, easy does it, and turn it over, and one day at a time. It's called fake it till you make it, itself an oft-invoked slogan. Everybody on a commitment who gets up publicly to speak starts out saying he's an alcoholic, says it whether he believes he is yet or not. Then everybody up there says how grateful he is to be sober today and how great it is to be active and out on a commitment with his group, even if he's not grateful or pleased about it at all. You're encouraged to keep saying stuff like this until you start to believe it, just like if you ask somebody with serious sober time
how long you'll have to keep schlepping to all these goddamn meetings, he'll smile that infuriating smile and tell you just until you start to want to go to all these goddamn meetings. There are some definite cultish, brainwashy elements to the AA program. The term program itself resonates darkly for those who fear getting brainwashed. And Gately tries to be candid with his residents regarding this issue. But he also shrugs and tells them that by the end of his oral narcotics and burglary careers, he'd sort of decided the old brain needed a good scrub and soak anyway. He says he pretty much held his brain out and told Pat Montesian and Gene M. to go ahead and wash away. But he tells his residents he's thinking now that the program might be more like deprogramming than actual washing, considering the psychic job the disease's spider has done on them all. Gately's most marked progress in turning his life around in sobriety, besides the fact that he no longer drives off into the night with other people's merchandise, is that he tries to be just about as verbally honest as possible at almost all times now, without too much calculation about how a listener's going to feel about what he says. This is harder than it sounds. But so that's why on commitments, sweating at the podium as only a large man can sweat, his thing is that he always says he's lucky to be sober today, instead of that he's grateful today, because he admits that the former is always true, every day, even though a lot of the time he still doesn't feel grateful, more like shocked that this thing seems to work, plus a lot of the time also ashamed and depressed about how he spent over half his life, and scared he might be permanently brain damaged or retarded from substances, plus also usually without any sort of clue about where he's headed in sobriety, or what he's supposed to be doing, or about really anything at all except that he's not at all keen to go back out there behind any bars again in a hurry. Ferocious Francis G. likes to punch Gately's shoulder and tell him he's right where he's supposed to be. So, but also know that casual attribution, like irony, is death. Speaking on commitments-wise, crocodile's temple veins will actually stand out and pulse with irritation if you start trying to blame your disease on some cause or other, and everybody with any kind of sober time will pale and writhe in their chair. See, for example, the white flag audience's discomfort when the skinny, hard-faced advanced basics girl who gets up to speak next to last posits that she was an 8-bag-a-day dope fiend because at 16, she'd had to become a stripper and semi-whore at the infamous Naked Eye Club out on Route 1. A number of male eyes in the audience flash with sudden recognition, and despite all willed restraint, automatically do that crawly north-to-south thing down her body, and Gately can see every ashtray on the table shake from the force of Joelle V's shudder. And then, but that she'd had to become a stripper at 16 because she'd had to run away from her foster home in Saugus, Massachusetts. And that she'd had to run away from home because, here at least, some of the room's discomfort is from the fact that the audience can tell the etiology is going to get head-clutchingly prolix and involved. This girl has not yet learned to keep it simple because, well, to begin with, she'd been adopted. And the foster parents also had their own biological daughter. And the biological daughter had, from birth, been totally paralyzed and retarded and catatonic. And the foster mother in the household was, as Joelle V. put it later to Gately, crazy as a fucking mudbug. And was in total denial about her biological daughter's being a vegetable. And not only insisted on treating the invertebrate biological daughter like a valid member of the chordate phylum, but also insisted that the father and the adopted daughter also treat it as normal and undamaged, and made the adopted daughter share a bedroom with it, bring it along to slumber parties. The speaker uses the term it for the invertebrate sister. And also, to tell the truth, uses the phrase drag it along rather than bring it along, which Gately wisely doesn't dwell over. And even to school with her, and softball practice, and the hairdressers, and campfire girls, etc., where at whatever place she'd dragged it along to, it would lie in a heap, drooling and incontinent under exquisite mother-bought fashions specially altered for atrophy and top-shelf Lancôme cosmetics that looked just lurid on it. And with only the whites of its eyes showing, with fluid dribbling from its mouth and elsewhere, and making unspeakable gurgly noises, completely pale and moist and stagnant. And then, when the adopted daughter, now speaking, turned 15, the rabidly Catholic wacko foster mother even announced that, okay, now that the adopted daughter was 15, she could go out on dates, but only as long as it got to come along too. In other words, that the only dates the 15-year-old adopted daughter could go out on were double dates with it and whatever submammalian escort the speaker could root up for it. And how this sort of stuff went on, and how the nightmarishness of its continual pale, soggy ubiquitousness in her young life would alone be more than sufficient to cause and explain the speaker's later drug addiction, she feels. But that also it so happened that the foster family's quiet, smiling patriarch, who worked 0900 to 2100 as a claims processor for Aetna, it turned out that the cheerful, smiling foster father actually made the wacko foster mother look like a Doric column of stability by comparison, because there turned out to be things about the biological daughter's utterly paralytic pliability and catatonic inability to make anything except unspeakable gurgly noises that the smiling father found greatly to a certain very sick advantage. The speaker says she has trouble openly discussing still, even at 31 months sober in AA, being as yet still so retroactively wounded and hurting from it. But so, in sum, that she's been ultimately forced to run away from the adoptive foster Saugus home, and so become a naked eye stripper, and so become a raging dope fiend, not, as in so many ununique cases, because she had been incestuously diddled, but because she'd been abusively forced to share a bedroom with a drooling invertebrate, who by 14 was itself getting incestuously diddled on a nightly basis by a smiling biological claims processor of a father, who, the speaker pauses to summon courage, who apparently liked to pretend it was Raquel Welch, the former celluloid sex goddess of the father's glandular heyday. And he even called it Raquel in moments of incestuous extremity. And how, the New England summer, the speaker turned 15 and had to start dragging it along on double dates and then having to make sure to drag it back home again by 2300 hours so it had plenty of time to be incestuously diddled. That summer, the smiling, quiet foster father even bought, had found somewhere, a cheesy rubber Raquel Welch full-head pull-on mask with hair and would now nightly come in the dark, and lift its limp, soft head up and struggle and lug to get the mask on and the relevant holes aligned for air, and then would diddle his way to extremity and cry out, "Raquel!" And then, but he would just clamor out and off and leave the dark bedroom smiling and sated and lots of times leave the mask still on it. He'd, like, forget or not care, just as he seemed oblivious, but for the grace of God, in a way, to the fetally curled skinny form of the adopted daughter lying perfectly still in the next bed in the dark, pretending to sleep, silent, shell-breathing, with her hard, skinny, wounded, pre-addiction face turned to the wall in the room's next bed, her bed, the one without the collapsible crib-like hospital railings along the sides. The audience is clutching its collective head, by this time only partly in empathy, as the speaker specifies how she was de facto emotionally all but like forced to flee and strip and swan dive into the dark spiritual anesthesia of active drug addiction in a dysfunctional attempt to psychologically deal with one particular seminally scarring night of abject horror. The indescribable horror of the way it, the biological daughter, had looked up at her, the speaker, one particular final time on this one particular one of the frequent occasions the speaker had to get out of bed after the father had come and gone and tiptoe over to its bed and lean over the cold metal hospital railing and remove the rubber Raquel Welch mask and replace it in a bedside drawer under some back issues of Ramparts and Commonweal. After carefully closing its splayed legs and pulling down its variously stained designer nightie, all of which she made sure to do when the father didn't bother to at night, so that the wacko foster mother wouldn't come in the AM and find it in a rubber Raquel Welch mask with its nightie hiked up and its legs agape, and put two and two together and get all kinds of deep denial shattered about why the foster father always went around the foster house with a silent, creepy smile, and flip out and make the invertebrate catatonic's father stop diddling it. Because, the speaker figured, if the foster father had to stop diddling it, it didn't exactly take Sally Jesse Raphael, MSW, to figure out who was then probably going to get promoted to the role of Raquel over in the next bed. The silent, smiling claims processor father never once acknowledged the adopted daughter's little post-incestuous tidyings up. It's the kind of sick, unspoken complicity, characteristic of wildly dysfunctional families, confides the speaker, who's also proud, she says, to be a member of a splinter 12-step fellowship, an adult child type thing called Wounded, Hurting, Inadequately Nurtured, but Ever Recovering Survivors. But so, she says, it was this one particular night soon after she turned 16, after the father had come and gone and uncaringly just left its mask on again, and over to its bedside the speaker had to creep in the dark, to tidy up. But this time it turned out there was a problem with the Raquel Welch mask's long auburn horsehair tresses having gotten twisted and knotted into the semi-living strands of its own elaborately overmoosed coiffure. And the adopted daughter had to activate the perimeter of lights on its bedside table's many-bubbled vanity mirror to see, to try to get the Raquel Welch wig untangled. And when she finally got the mask off, with the vanity mirror still blazing away, the speaker says how she was forced to gaze for the first time on its lit-up, paralytic, post-diddle face, and how the expression thereon was most assuredly quite enough to force anybody with an operant limbic system
142
to leg it right out of her dysfunctional foster family's home. Nay, and the whole community of Saugus, Massachusetts, now homeless and scared and forced by dark psychic forces straight to Route One's infamous gauntlet of neon light depravity and addiction to try and forget, Raza the tabula, wipe the memory totally out, numb it with opiates. Voice trembling, she accepts the chairperson's proffered bandana hanky and blows her nose one nostril at a time and says she can almost see it all over again, its expression. In the vanity's lights, only its eyes' whites showed. And while its utter catatonia and paralysis prevented the contraction of its luridly rouged face's circumoral muscles into any conventional human facial type expression, nevertheless, some hideously mobile and expressive layer in the moist regions below real people's expressive facial layer, some slow twitch layer unique to it, had blindly contracted somehow to gather the blank, soft cheese of its face into the sort of pinched, gasping look of neurologic concentration that marks a carnal bliss beyond smiles or sighs. Its face looked post-coital, sort of the way you'd imagine the vacuole and optica of a protozoan-looking post-coital after it's shuttered and shot its monocellular load into the cold waters of some really old sea. Its facial expression was, in a word, the speaker says, unspeakably, unforgettably ghastly and horrid and scarring. It was also the exact same expression as the facial expression on the stone-robed lady's face in this one untitled photo of some Catholic statue that hung, the photo, in the dysfunctional household's parlor right above the little teak table where the dysfunctional foster mother kept her beads and hours and lay breviary. This photo of a statue of a woman whose stone robes were half hiked up and wrinkled in the most god-awfully, sensually, prurient way. The woman reclined against uncut rock, her robes hiked and one stone foot hanging off the rock as her legs hung parted, with a grinning little, totally psychotic-looking cherub-type angel standing on the lady's open thighs and pointing a bare arrow at where the stone robe hit her cold tit. The woman's face upturned and cocked and pinched into that exact same shuddering, protozoan look beyond pleasure or pain. The wacko foster mom knelt daily to that photo, in a beaded and worshipful posture, and also required daily that it be hoisted by the adopted daughter from its never-mentioned wheelchair and held under its arms and lowered so as to approximate the same knelt devotion to the picture. And while it gurgled and its head lolled, the speaker had gazed at the photo with a nameless revulsion each morning as she held its dead slumped weight and tried to keep its chin off its chest, and now was being forced into seeing by mirror light the exact same expression on the face of a catatonic who'd just been incestuously diddled, an expression at once reverent and greedy on a face connected by dead hair to the slack and flapping rubber visage of an old sex goddess's empty face. And, to make a long story short, the speaker says, not trying to be funny as far as the flaggers can see, the traumatically scarred adopted daughter had legged it from the bedroom and foster home into the brooding North Shore teen runaway night, and had stripped and semi-whored and IV-injected her way all the way to that standard two-option addicted cliff edge, hoping only to forget. That's what caused it, she says. That's what she's trying to recover from, a day at a time. And she's sure grateful to be here with her group today, sober and courageously remembering, and newcomers should definitely keep coming. As she's telling what she sees as etiological truth, even though the monologue seems sincere and unaffected, and at least a B-plus on the overall AA story lucidity scale, faces in the hall are averted and hands clutched and postures uneasily shifted in empathetic distress at the look-what-happened-to-poor-me invitation implicit in the tale. The talk's tone of self-pity itself less offensive, even though plenty of these white flaggers, Gately knows, had personal childhoods that made this girl's look like a day at Six Flags Over the Poconos. Then the subcurrent of explanation, an appeal to exterior cause that can slide in the addictive mind so insidiously into excuse that any causal attribution is, in Boston AA, feared, shunned, punished by empathetic distress. The why of the disease is a labyrinth. It is so strongly suggested all AA's boycott. Inhabited, as the maze is, by the twin minotaurs of why me and why not, also known as self-pity and denial. Two of the smiley-faced sergeant-at-arms, more fearsome aides-de-camp. The Boston AA in here that protects against a return to out there is not about explaining what caused your disease. It's about a goofily simple practical recipe for how to remember you've got the disease day by day and how to treat the disease day by day. How to keep the seductive ghost of a bliss long absconded from baiting you and hooking you and pulling you back out and eating your heart raw and, if you're lucky, eliminating your map for good. So, no whys or wherefores allowed. In other words, check your head at the door. Though it can't be conventionally enforced, this Boston AA's real root axiom is almost classically authoritarian, maybe even proto-fascist. Some ironist who decamped back out there and left his meager effects to be bagged and tossed by staff into the Ennett House addict had, all the way back in the year of the Tuck's medicated pad, permanently engraved his tribute to AA's real prime directive with a rosewood-handled boot knife in the plastic seat of the five-man men's room's commode. Do not ask why if you don't want to die. Do like you're told if you want to get old.
143.
The 30th of April to the 1st of May, Year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. The choreography of Interface had settled into the form of steeply smoking, his bare arms crossed, going up and down slowly on the toes of his high heels, while Marat hunched slightly in his metal chair, shoulders rounded and head slightly forward in a practiced position that allowed him almost to sleep while still attending to every detail of a conversation or wearisome surveillance. He, Marat, had drawn his plaid blanket up to his chest. It was increasingly chilly at the altitude of the shelf. They could feel the remains of the USA Sonora Desert's heat rising past them into the clotted spangle of stars that were above them. The shirt Marat wore beneath his windbreaker was not of Hawaiian type. Marat remained unsure in this time of what exactly it was that Hugh Steepley of USOUS wished to learn from him or verify through Marat's betrayal. Near midnight, Steepley had given him the datum that he, Steepley, had been on the personal marital leave over his recent divorce and was now back in the field of duty, wearing prosthetic breasts and woman journalist credentials, assigned to cultivate some of the entertainment's alleged filmmaker's relatives and inner circles. Marat had made gentle fun of the inoriginality of a journalistic cover, then later less gentle fun of Steepley's cover's false name, expressing humored doubts that the meaty, electrolyzed face of Steepley would be responsible for launching even one ship or vessel. There'd been that first brutal winter night, early in the ONANite, temporo-subsidized era, soon after the interlaced dissemination of the man who began to suspect he was made of glass, that himself emerged from the sauna and came to Lyle all sloppy blotto and depressed over the fact that even the bastards in the avant-garde journals were complaining that even in his commercially entertaining stuff, Incandenza's fatal Achilles heel was plot. That Incandenza's efforts had no sort of engaging plot, no movement that sucked you in and drew you along.
144.
Mario and Ms. Joelle Van Dyne are probably the only people who know that found drama,
145,
and anti-confluentialism both came out of this night with Lyle. It's not like Boston AA recoils from the idea of responsibility, though. Cause, no. Responsibility, yes. It seems like it all depends on which way the arrow of presumed responsibility points. The hard-faced adopted stripper had presented herself as the object of an outside cause. Now the arrow comes back around as tonight's meeting's last and maybe best advanced basic speaker, another newcomer, a round pink girl with no eyelashes at all, and a bass head's ruined teeth, gets up there and speaks in an R-less South Boston brogue about being pregnant at 20 and smoking 8 balls of freebase cocaine like a fiend all through her pregnancy, even though she knew it was bad for the baby and wanted desperately to quit. She tells about having her water break and contractions start late one night in her welfare hotel room when she was right in the middle of an 8-ball. She'd had to spend the evening turning unbelievably sordid and degrading tricks to pay for. She did what she had to do to get high, she says, even while pregnant, she says. And she says even when the pain of the contractions got to be too bad to bear, she'd been unable to tear herself away from the base pipe to go to the free clinic to deliver. And how she'd sat on the floor of the welfare hotel room and freebased her way all through labor. That new Joelle girl's veils billowing in and out with her breath, Gately sees, just like it also was during the last speaker's description of the statue's orgasm in the catatonic's dysfunctional Catholic mother's devotional photo. And how she'd finally delivered of a stillborn infant, right there, alone on her side like a cow on the rug of her room, all the time throughout, still compulsively loading up the glass pipe and smoking. And how the infant emerged all dry and hard, like a constipated turdlet, with no protective moisture and no afterbirth material following it out. And how the emerged infant was tiny and dry and all withered in the color of strong tea and dead, and also had no face, had in utero developed no eyes or nostrils, and just a little lipless hyphen of a mouth, and its limbs were malformed and arachnodactylic, and there had been some sort of translucent reptilian-like webbing between its mucronate digits. The speaker's mouth is a quivering arch of woe. Her baby had been poisoned before it could grow a face or make any personal choices. It would have soon died of substance withdrawal in the free clinic's Pyrex incubator if it had emerged alive anyway, she could tell.